This could be your year.
To On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2 SER in Sydney and broadcast nationally. Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2 SER and broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and this week we take a look at the same-sex marriage plebiscite. What could it cost and are there any alternatives? We also find out that there was a revolution happening in Africa. Not the political kind, but the agrarian kind. And it's all because of the uptake of the smartphone that this could be possible on that continent. But first, late last month, the Minister for Revenue and Financial Services, Kelly O'Dwyer, announced that the government will introduce legislation into Parliament later this year to amend a loophole in the Superannuation Act. The loophole has been used by some businesses to reduce the amount of superannuation contribution they are obliged to pay their workers, if the workers sacrifice part of their salary. Currently, the law offers no distinction between a contribution from salary sacrificing or from an employer contribution. This means some employers have been either counting their employees' salary sacrifice as part of their own obligation or calculating the 9.5% from the post-sacrifice salary, a lower amount. So what does this mean for you? And does this loophole affect you? Nora Zahr has this report.
When the Superannuation Guarantee Law was drafted some 25 years ago, it doesn't seem like lawmakers did take into consideration the possibility that some employers might use a loophole to shortchange their employees. Super Guarantee Rule requires businesses to pay their workers 9.5% of their ordinary time earnings into their super account. But under the existing law, employers can count their employees' own voluntary contributions towards the super contribution they're supposed to pay. So, for example, if you salary sacrifice 9.5% of your $100,000 salary, this would reduce the salary on which your employer calculates the super guarantee to $90,500. Salary sacrifice is a way to contribute to super from your pre-tax salary. It's a useful way to increase your retirement income. But this loophole could potentially mean that your overall contributions don't increase overall. Earlier today, I spoke to Gordon McKinsey, senior lecturer at the UNSW School of Taxation and Business Law. And he says this loophole essentially means that employees may be shortchanging themselves by contributing to their retirement through salary sacrificing. So why has this issue been brought into the spotlight now?
It's simply part of
the Minister for Revenue and Financial
of the super guarantee that the government's put in place. And this is a second or third order issue. It's been there ever since superannuation guarantee has been in place, which is since 1992. My guess, as I said, is that it's only because of the bigger review that's going on. The bigger review that's going on is dealing with straight avoidance, and that is employers simply not contributing to their employees' superannuation fund. And that's a much more significant issue. The thing we're talking about is, as I said, second or third order, and it has been there for a while, and I think they're just taking the opportunity now of cleaning up.
In December of last year, the Minister for Revenue and Financial Services, Kelly O'Dwyer, set up an inter-agency working group to look into the issue of unpaid super. The working group included senior representatives from the Australian Taxation Office, the Treasury, the Department of Employment, and financial regulators, ASIC and APRA. The working group was set up following the release of a report by Industry Super Australia and CPAS Super, which found that around 365,000 employees are being shortchanged by their employers. This means an employee loses around $1,490, or almost 4 months of superannuation contributions a year, due to the salary sacrifice loophole.
That's a significant amount of contributions for the average wage earner. And given that superannuation is a long-term investment, money in the superannuation fund you're not going to get access to for 30 or 40 years, to, from depending on when you start work. If you take into account the investment earnings that that $1,500 a year they're losing would have generated over that period of time, it is a significant amount of money.
What do you think the long-term effect would be on, say, the industry, the superannuation industry, the government? If that loophole is not rectified, is that going to have a long-term effect?
I'll be blunt with you. It's not going to be a major effect. But the fact of the matter is that loophole, employer is having the employee fund the employer's obligation to pay 9.5%, and that just doesn't seem reasonable. The reason I it's probably not going to be significant is because the majority of Australians are not going to have sufficient retirement funding to prevent them from accessing the age pension. It's just a function of the amount that they put into a superannuation fund to fund their retirement.
And moving forward, for people who salary sacrifice, what's your advice to them really to make sure that they are not being ripped off, to make sure that they're actually getting paid the correct amount?
The fact of the matter is that the majority of people who salary sacrifice will have financial knowledge and know what's going on. I don't think you can really expect everybody, certainly people who are outside the accounting and finance community, to monitor that. It's a good question. Maybe the answer would be that the ATO should make people aware of what their entitlements are, because they're the tax collector and they're the people that administer the super guarantee. Perhaps in their education of taxpayers, they could let people know what the 9.5% contribution level should be, and then they can review that with their own superannuation fund.
UNSW Senior Lecturer Gordon McKenzie there, ending that report by Noor Azhar.
On the Money, hedge your bets and stay tuned.
Around their paddocks automatically, but in the recent conference held in Sydney on food security, Andy Jarvis gave the keynote address called Transforming Lives and Livelihoods, the Digital Revolution in Agriculture. Andy lives in Cali, Colombia, and he explains that with the spread of technology, such as smartphones and other 3G services, that these things could be transformative for smallholder farming, and now's the time to digitise agriculture and democratise the benefits for the 570 million smallholders around the globe who produce 70% of the world's food. I spoke with Andy to find out how this might work.
We're starting from a baseline of agriculture really not being very digitalized. You know, it's not taken advantage of the digital revolution. And there are studies out there kind of putting it, you know, 23rd out of 23 sectors in terms of the kind of taking advantage of digital opportunities. So we're starting from a low baseline. I mean, I think that's a huge opportunity. You know, I think there's an enormous amount of opportunity using data and the revolution, the kind of data revolution that's coming to improve farming.
One of the things that I've noticed in Australia is that with harvesting and those sorts of things, that they can use the GPS to have everything really running by itself in the way that the machines go up and down the fields, which I thought was pretty amazing. But it's going on further than that, is it?
Well, I mean, that right now is the kind of cutting edge in the kind of developed world commercial agriculture. It's kind of it's piggybacking the tractor, sensors on the tractor, GPS is driving the tractor, and a real precision kind of management using sensors, image recognition, and all sorts. So that's where it's at there. But I mean, what we're doing, what we're very interested in looking, well, what does that kind of digital revolution in developed world agriculture look like for the kind of smallholder farmer in agriculture in Africa? So we're looking at kind of what are the models there? How can we use these kinds of technologies, but in a very different context? And a lot of it is about using mobile phones, using kind of cheap, more appropriate technologies for smallholder farmers in Africa to be making the right decisions.
The way that a mobile phone, of course, it only has a certain amount of processing power, but I guess is it the fact that it has the GPS tracking ability which is going to make it useful?
Well, I mean, you know, one angle is that. I mean, just the fact that you can transmit information through mobile phones. So just providing kind of personalized information to farmers of rain and kind of weather forecasts or seasonal forecasts, things like digital extension, providing farmers with kind of information that with the conditions of your farm and the soil types that you have, then these kinds of varieties might be the ones you should try out. Stuff like that. You know, it's actually it's simple information can be very, very, very useful right now. But then I think, you know, moving forward, there's also things like the image recognition for identifying pests and diseases. So, you know, a farmer could take a photo of a plant that's suffering from some kind of ailment, and you can have automated kind of analyses of that photo that throw back a kind of recommendation. Well, it looks like you've got this virus, you know, and then information on how you might treat it. So it's really about just connecting the dots on information and providing farmers with very kind of simple but actionable information that really, really could be transformative, certainly on the smallholder farming front.
So is that where your $30 million initiative is going to help by sort of be information central for a lot of these small holding farmers?
Well, we want to kind of systematically kickstart much more data collection and sharing in the agricultural sector, from the farms through to the researchers and the institutions involved. So we want to create a lot more of a kind of data ecosystem in Africa around farming. But then what we want to do is bring new partnerships to the table and figure out, well, what are some of the really intractable problems smallholder agriculture is facing right now, and how might we find these kind of new approaches that could disrupt it a little bit, bring technology to the fold. So we're identifying these problems that are kind of ripe for disruption, and then facilitating processes and kind of new partnerships and projects on the ground to solve it.
And you've got some major corporations involved, like IBM, Amazon, PepsiCo, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. How did you get all those people on board?
Well, I mean, I think there's a huge amount of interest right now. This has kind of been for the huge corporations and things. I've been going to conferences and seeing kind of the cutting edge in, you know, in Australia and Europe and the US of agriculture. They see big business opportunity there, but in you know, in Africa, it's really, they just don't know. There's very few kind of entry points for business around this. And so I think they're interested in looking at kind of opening up new business opportunities, understanding the terrain a little bit better. And the only way we're going to solve this is by bringing the kind of cutting edge private sector, the kind of the great kind of universities working on robotics and artificial intelligence and these things to the table, you know. So bringing new players to tackle the problem, that's really what we're about, is this kind of new partnerships with it.
But sort of for the here and now, the big thing is going to be the information for small holdings. I mean, maybe even things like long-range weather forecasts, that can make a big difference to whether you plant or you don't plant, for instance, couldn't it?
No, absolutely. I mean, and that's the transformational stuff. I mean, you can. It sounds kind of like, you know, simple stuff that you'd hear on the news, you know, kind of in Australia maybe, but getting good, robust seasonal forecasts of 4 to 6 months when the rains are going to arrive in West Africa, for example, getting good information about that and getting it out through different channels, including mobile phones, can be transformational for farmers. You know, they can manage their risks much better, choosing when to plant, what kinds of varieties they might plant. And that's where we've already had some success stories on the ground, is using this kind of climate services through ICTs, through mobile phones and things.
And you think it could, the market could also be part of this as well, so that they become less subsistence and, more market-based?
Yeah, and market intelligence is another kind of one of these areas where there's been quite a few early wins. You know, using SMS, simple SMS text messages every morning that a farmer gets saying, what's the price of tomatoes in two or three different markets from, different villages around where their farm is. That kind of information, again, can help the farmer get a better deal spur them on to kind of increasing kind of income for the farm household through commercial agriculture.
And what about across borders? Do you think it can help there as well, getting, crops going back and forth or resources and so forth?
Well, I mean, one of the things we're very interested in looking at is kind of understanding food systems better. And so that cross-border trade in food in Africa is, there's a huge volume of food moving across borders, and generally it's informal. And so we have terrible data on what food is moving where, what kinds of volumes, how it changes. Right now there's a famine across six countries have been kind of declared in famine in Africa. Much of the food is coming from other countries, and we don't actually know where it's coming from, how that's changed during this famine. And so we're very interested in using kind of big data related technology to better track food systems, understand price dynamics, understand where food is being produced, where it's going to, where it's being consumed, by who it's being consumed. So we see that as a big opportunity as well, of using kind of big data and using different information flows to understand it better.
Yeah, and a lot of this has come around really because of the advent or of the uptake of the mobile phone in Africa, which gives the processing power to sort of every single African in a way, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, and I mean, I always tout this one statistic, which I still find every time I say it, amazing. I mean, there's more people have access to a mobile phone than they do kind of modern toilets. so in the space of one decade, you know, this one technology has just penetrated, you know, every corner of the continent practically. And I keep getting kind of asked here in Australia about, like, kind of, well, what about the coverage, the kind of data coverage, 3G? And the answer is, I mean, in Kenya, for example, I can expect much better 3G mobile coverage than I can in many parts of Europe in the US. That's been an incredible revolution. You know, and I would say it's kind of been a technology revolution, but really, it's ripe now for the kind of the data revolution following it up and hitting and reaching farmers.
Andy Jarvis speaking with me there, and we certainly hope he can be the catalyst for a digital revolution in poor nations around the world.
On the Money, making mountains out of moolah.
I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to On the Money, broadcast live on the Community Radio Network. Well, the federal government has announced that it will be holding a postal plebiscite on the issue of same-sex marriage. But what will the cost for this be? Some predictions are that it will cost around $122 million. How else could the government resolve this issue? Kevin Suarez spoke to Dr. Bly Grant, senior lecturer at the Institute for Public Policy and Governance at the University of Technology, Sydney, to find out just how this plebiscite might work.
A real plebiscite is, quote, the direct vote of all electors on an important public question. So what we're looking at for this particular exercise is a non-compulsory vote that's run by the Australian Bureau of Statistics on the question of whether or not same-sex couples should be able to marry legally under Australian law. So we've got plebiscite on the one hand, and we've got what the conservative side of the Liberal Party has organised for there, and in fact our Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull to run in order to either resolve the issue or bury the issue forever. So there's a big difference between the plebiscite on the one hand and what's happening on the other. And that's the basis for the High Court challenge, which in all probability will be coming up. Yep.
So why has the idea of a plebiscite on the topic been so controversial?
Well, it's been controversial, Kevin, because it's not a plebiscite. But that's one reason. But there's a lot of reasons why the idea of what the ABS is going to run to address this question are controversial in the context of Australian democracy, in particular in the context of Australian democracy. The first one is that we have a very strong tradition of compulsory voting in this country. Now, that's unlike the United States. It's unlike the United Kingdom. They're very important points of reference for our democracy. And that compulsory voting is long-standing and it reaches all across the different jurisdictions. So that's the first point. The second point is that, and this quote-unquote plebiscite is non-compulsory. Second point is that we have a very strong tradition of very robust parliamentary democracies, not just at the federal level, but also at the state levels as well. So the implication of compulsory voting and having very robust parliamentary debate is when you have a very serious issue, you take it to the parliament because that's what we vote our politicians in to do under representative democracy. They're there to do the hard work of politics. Now, undertaking this exercise, which is an opinion poll run by the ABS, which is a data collecting statutory corporation of federal government, is resoundingly against those very strong democratic principles that really define Australian democracy and set us apart from other parliamentary democracies, republican democracies. And some people could argue that it's really, as Penny Wong said in the Senate yesterday, it's a handball pass. I'd say that's quite a weak metaphor. It's really outsourcing what should be a problem that's dealt with in the realm of politics, which is our parliament.
This postal plebiscite is predicted to cost the taxpayers millions of dollars. But how can it be so incredibly expensive when they're just sending out pieces of paper for an opinion poll?
We know that it's going to cost around about $122 million, and chances are it's not going to come in underneath that. So, you know, that's a budget projection, so it's probably going to be a little bit more than that. And obviously to send out a particular, and in a way, this really a demonstrative of how arcane this whole exercise is, that we're sending out ABS, is the Australian Bureau of Statistics, is actually sending out, presumably it will be a form that we tick yes or no to one particular proposition. So that's quite an expensive exercise. In order for it to be legitimate in any stretch of the imagination, even though it's non-compulsory, it has to go to everyone who's eligible to vote. So that's quite a lot of people. What is it? 22 million people. It's got to, minus the children and things like that, it's probably got to go to 15 million people. That's an expensive exercise.
So what would you say would be a more economically viable way of reaching a conclusion on this topic?
Well, the economically viable way of reaching a conclusion on this topic is for the Parliament of Australia to do the job that it's elected to do, and that is to debate and resolve particular issues such as this. Now, this is a difficult issue because the Liberal Party is split over the question of marriage equality, but it's not an irresolvable issue. It's just as simple as that. The fact that we have a bicameral parliament, we have a lower house, House of Representatives, and an upper house, the Senate, which is the state's house, does make it more difficult to get legislation through, but that's what the parliament's for. And it is the job of parliament to do precisely that, not to turn around and say, oh, we can't solve this problem, so we're going to call another election. Why? Because that's bloody expensive. And you can imagine if it's expensive now, when we wrote the Constitution in 1901, it was comparatively even more expensive. But that's what should be occurring. In fact, and not coincidentally, that's the most cost-effective way to address the issue.
So going to an election, how much would that cost compared to, say, holding a plebiscite or holding a referendum?
Well, according to the Australian Electoral Commission, latest data for which is the federal election of 2013, cost $193,744,374. So let's say that the 2016 election cost $200 million. So, you know, almost $250 million. That's quite a, you know, fair chunk of money. Democracy does cost money. At the same time, it also is responsible for a lot of wealth generation. Let's not forget that. A separate poll as opposed to what the ABS, what's proposed, will happen. A separate poll would likely cost around $158 million, according to the Australian Electoral Commission. The reason why they're running it through the ABS as opposed to the Australian Electoral Commission and making it a non-compulsory opinion poll, doesn't actually require all of the citizens to vote, is because it would be subject to constitutional challenge, or more subject to constitutional challenge, if it was run by the AEC and it was compulsory. Then people would presumably have grounds to say, hang on a second, this looks very much like it should be an issue that's sorted out in the parliament, not outsourced to the Australian Electoral Commission. And a lot of politicians from across the dispatch box, that is on the Labor Party side, have been comparing the $122 million to cost of the opinion poll to what else could be spent. So, for example, Penny Wong said in the Senate day it's equivalent to 3 million visits to a general practitioner or a doctor. It's equivalent to, wait for it, 7 times what the government currently spends on Indigenous legal services. This is according to Denham Sadler, who was writing in the newsfeed Junkie yesterday. It's double the spending on the Close the Gap employment programs, for example, in 1 year. And it's 4 times the spending on research and development for curing HIV/AIDS. So it's quite a lot of money when you do stack it up against things that we could spend 120. It doesn't sound like a lot, does it, Kevin? 122 millions is a bit of a drop in the ocean these days when we're used to throwing around billions of dollars. But the opportunity costs, as economists would call it, are quite high.
Dr. Bly Grant there, senior lecturer at the Institute for Public Policy and Governance at the University of Technology, Sydney, ending that report by Kevin Suarez.
My name is François Carrière. I am at the UTS Business School, and you are listening to On the Money, summing up finance in one easy bite.
That's all we have for you on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about money, finance, and business. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. You can find all of our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. Thanks to our producers Noor Azhar and Kevin Suarez. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Put it on your friends' phones as well. Follow us on Twitter, look for @onthemoney2SER, and find us on Facebook. I'm Roderick Chambers. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
Storyology is the Walkley Foundation's annual festival of journalism and storytelling. This August, join the best journalists from across Australia and around the world at the Darlinghurst Theatre for discussion, debate, training and networking. Check out the full program and purchase tickets online at walkleys.com. Students can use the offer code STUDENT at checkout to get 20% off full Storyology passes. Storyology, sponsors of 2SER.
Listen closely. This is the sound of a brain that's been to UTS School of Communication. Listen again. This is the sound of a brain that hasn't. So, if your bosses need to make decisions to make things happen for them at work, which would you think they'd rather have?
Make your future happen. Apply to UTS School of Communication, the number one young uni. UTS School of Communication, sponsors of 2SER.
The Loft Bar at UTS on Broadway opens from 2 until late every weekday, making it the perfect spot for an early finish or relaxing after work. With craft beer, seasonal draft specials and cocktails on tap, come and unwind in the Loft's shady courtyard, soundtracked each evening by local acoustic musicians. The Loft Bar at UTS on Broadway is your inner city oasis in the heart of Ultimo. 2SER sponsors.
What have you always wondered about Sydney and the